This panel discusses the prospects and possible outcomes of litigation involving some critical issues in the current political debate, challenges of the 14th Amendment's guarantee of birthright citizenship, right of public education under Plyler v. Doe, and the extent to which states and localities can affect laws affecting the foreign-born. Muzaffar Chishti, director of the Migration Policy Institute's office at the New York University Law School, opens the panel discussion.
So this is the panel that is formally called the final arbiters when immigration policies come before the courts. Let me introduce our very distinguished panelists. You have their detailed bios, so it's pointless for me to repeat all of what's said there, but just to say a word or two about them, just to tell you how lucky we are to have this distinguished group of people to parse out what we believe is going to be a very important set of discussions. And we are focused here on what's out there in the landscape of litigation. Where are the courts today in issues that have already come as far up to the Supreme Court or at the courts of appeals level to all the way down, which are not even litigation as yet, but sort of are gleams in the eyes of some legislators and everything in between. And we hope to cover most of this in the course of this 1 hour. And the three distinguished panels for this are truly uniquely qualified to parse out this for us. On my left is Umar Jadwat, who is the staff counsel at the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project. Those of you law students will take inspiration. This young man graduated only 9 years ago at NYU Law School and was the lead counsel in the Hazleton case, was the lead counsel in the SB 1070, was the lead co-counsel in the Candelaria case before the Supreme Court. On my immediate right is David Martin. Many of you know him extremely well. He is the Warner Booker Distinguished Professor of International Law at University of Virginia, where he has built a huge record as an extremely impressive scholar at the intersection of immigration law, constitutional law, and international human rights. David also served three different tours of duty for our country in three different administrations. He worked at the Department of State in the Carter administration. He was a general counsel of the INS in the Clinton administration, and until very recently, he was the principal deputy general counsel of DHS in the Obama administration. On our extreme right is Mike Vishney. He's the clinical professor of law at Yale Law School. I think most of us agree that more than any other lawyer of his generation, he has pushed the envelope the hardest and the farthest in using most novel and untested legal theories to hold our government accountable for their acts. And the process has also inspired a new generation of young lawyers to push that envelope even further. David and Mike do so two other distinctions. They share two other distinctions. They were both clerks at the Supreme Court, where they have watched at close angle how those difficult 5-4 decisions get made. And they're also both the non-resident fellows at MPI, and it's not my place to say which of them is the more important distinction. So with that introduction, let's start with the most of the ripe issues, which is already at the Supreme Court. In fact, we had hoped that before today, the Supreme Court would have ruled on the first Arizona employer sanctions law, which was enacted in 2007, popularly called Candelaria versus Arizona. Is that what it is exactly? Umar will correct me. And it was argued in December. The decision expected any time now. So, Umar, let me start with you. Tell us what the Candelaria case is and what are the issues there.
Sure. The case is now actually called Chamber of Commerce versus Whiting. And I think one of the interesting things about the case is inherent in its title, which was that it was a case against Arizona's anti-immigrant employment laws that included both an E-Verify mandate and an employer sanction scheme. This was a case, as it made its way up to the Supreme Court, that was spearheaded really by the business community. We heard, earlier on about some of the increasing willingness of the business community to get involved in these state immigration issues. This is a case where the Chamber of Commerce was there as a lead plaintiff, where we were involved representing civil rights groups, where labor unions were submitting amicus briefs in our support, and where obviously also the federal government ultimately came in on our side of the case as well. So that case, as we actually heard in the last panel, was argued in December before the Supreme Court in the beginning of December, and we're awaiting a decision. The question in the case, in a certain sense, are pretty narrow. They involve whether Arizona can create its own employer sanction system, that is, its own system of punishment for employers who hire unauthorized workers, and also whether they can require all of the employers in the state to participate in the voluntary federal E-Verify system. The first part of that question, the first question in the case may be decided primarily on express preemption grounds, and which are specific really to these employer sanctions issues. So we're waiting for a decision. It could have come down this morning. It didn't. It can come down obviously at any time between now and the end of June. The situation in terms of the lower courts is that the Third Circuit has found that a very similar law was unconstitutional because it was preempted. The Ninth Circuit found differently in the Arizona case below, and so there's a kind of clear split on how the circuits perceive the issue.
And what's your argument against the law?
The argument is that both that federal law explicitly prescribes states from enacting laws like this, because when Congress enacted IRCA in 1986, it banned states from imposing sanctions on employers who hire unauthorized workers with an exception for licensing and similar schemes. Arizona's argument is that their scheme is a licensing scheme. We think that is a gross overreading of the parenthetical. And I think, Justice Scalia actually said it best in the oral argument in the case. He said, I think it's clear that Congress, when it passed this law, wasn't envisioning anything like the Arizona law coming to pass, which, we think makes fairly, which is our view too, and which we think makes pretty clear that Arizona can't pass this law. But we'll see how it works out.
So what are the seven parenthetical words that got us all the way to the Supreme Court?
Other than through licensing and similar schemes is the parenthetical exception. The whole question is basically how big a loophole that is in practice and in our view, whether it can be looked at so broadly that it swallows the rule. Because Arizona's goal when it created this law, I think, is quite clearly to create a very different penalty scheme than the one that Congress enacted, and to create its own system for deciding which employers have violated the law and which have not.
So, David, you were the principal deputy general counsel of the DHS when the Obama administration recommended to the Supreme Court that they take this case and grant the cert. What was behind the government's thinking in saying the Supreme Court should take this case?
Well, let me first, if I could start by putting it a little bit more into context. The government had not taken a position, had not sought to intervene or be an amicus in the earlier stages here, and I think that reflects an ambivalence that's gone through and really a couple of at least impulses that are in tension that have applied across administrations. One of those is, of course, to protect the primary, the important, the dominant federal role in overall immigration enforcement and management. But on the other hand, there is support for the E-Verify system, even if it's ultimately needs to be voluntary, a belief that has been a valuable system that has grown, that there have been improvements in its accuracy, and a way of supporting it. One other element here, too, I think, is to put it in the political context of Arizona. A few years ago when it was adopted, there were several measures that were adopted. This was the one that was signed by a governor named Napolitano, in part to respond to something that Tamar Jacoby talked about in the first panel, How do you manage this kind of impulse for really strong enforcement? Can you do it simply by saying no, or do you need to find an alternative? And among the various measures in which that impulse might find an outlet, I think there's a fair case to be made that greater support for E-Verify, requiring E-Verify involvement, is one of the least harmful, one of the least incompatible with overall federal objectives. But anyway, in that overall context, the federal government had not been involved. The Supreme Court asked for the Solicitor General's views. There was a discussion, and clearly the thought that this particular reading of the licensing exception that was reflected in the Ninth Circuit was too expansive, and also some concern about the ways in which this was before SB 1070, potential implications for broader claims about preemption on down the road. Now, having said all that, I think it's possible. It's interesting. It's a little bit puzzling that it's taking the court so long to deal with this. I think it is possible for the court to resolve this the way the Ninth Circuit did, with a very narrow focus on the licensing exception to overall preemption, which would mean that this would have rather limited impact outside of schemes of exactly this type. So even if the court, whichever way the court rules here, it won't necessarily give a clear indication that will be all that helpful in the larger, the more intensive litigation, the higher stakes litigation over legislation like SB 1070.
And Mike, we know that Justice Kagan is conflicted on this case, so it's likely that only obviously 8 justices are going to decide that. Does that change the possible outcome in one way or the other?
Sure. It could be that part of the case is affirmed by an equally divided court, 4-4, leaving the Ninth Circuit decision in place. But I think I agree with what Omar and David have said, that it's too early to know. I mean, we'll read it when it comes down. It could be a narrow and largely unimportant case about the details of the Arizona statute and how they fit with the details of the federal statute. And nothing more than that. Or it could be very broad and sweeping, a broad endorsement or a broad rejection of state activity in this area. I'm glad the government came in, and we'll know by the end of June. I can't resist but say that this little discussion on Candelaria is sort of Exhibit A in why I at least completely reject the title of this panel, the courts as the final arbiters. I don't think the courts have the last word on practically any of this stuff. I think there's a slow developing conversation between legislatures, the federal agencies, and the courts. And I doubt that this will be the last word. If the court strikes this down, Arizona may try something different. If they uphold it, it may be that other challenges arise. But I don't think this is likely to be the last word, regardless of how the court comes out in this case.
Yeah, we picked titles off our panels just to be provocative, and obviously we succeeded. So if this is a 4-4 decision, which is likely, what does that mean for Hazleton, which is still a Third Circuit?
Right. So Hazleton is the case that that actually preceded the Arizona case in time, but has now lagged as it's made its way up through the courts. That's a case that involves a city that passed a employer sanctions and E-Verify regime that resembles the Arizona one, but also passed a set of laws restricting housing on the basis of immigration status. There's a bunch of those laws around the country as well, and all of those laws have been defeated in the courts, unlike the employer sanctions law, laws which have had a more mixed result. If there's still something to be decided in the Supreme Court on the employer sanctions issues, it's possible that they might take Hazleton, or at least part of Hazleton, to resolve that. Certainly our view is that the housing-related issues, there's no disagreement among the courts for the Supreme Court to resolve. It seems clear, as every court that has looked at these questions has decided, that is not something that cities or states are free to do, to decide that, you know, they're going to condition residents on immigration status. We wouldn't expect that issue to be before the court soon, but, you know, obviously we'll know in time. Probably soon after they decide the Arizona case, what they're going to do with the Hazleton petition.
So, David, just on just the candidate, one last thing. Since this all revolves around the interpretation of the seven parenthetical words that Congress wrote in 86, which you and I both remember, do you think there's any possibility of congressional action after the Supreme Court decision, one way or the other?
Well, there's always possibility of congressional action. The problem has been that immigration legislation generally is so radioactive that any little piece, which could then be the vehicle for additional immigration measures, scares a lot of people. I was quite struck when I came back to Washington in late 2008 and early 2009 about the great reluctance of so many people on the Hill to take on immigration legislation unless you're going to really incur the pain for a big overall solution. It's just a personally wearing, nasty, difficult issue. So I don't know that we will see that. But that does raise. I don't think we'll see that immediately. I think it'll be an issue that will then go into the mix for a broader range of discussions. Two other things I'd like to say, though. I'm pretty sure we won't see a 4-4 decision on everything. Typically, the court's pattern has been if they're split 4-4, they issue a brief per curiam very shortly after the decision, just saying that they're split and the lower court decision stands. It could go that way on some issues, but it clearly, I think pretty clearly, hasn't done that on all of them. Furthermore, we look at these cases, preemption cases, and we talk about rulings from courts that say that the particular state or local measure is unconstitutional. And to some extent, that's right, because it's an application of the Supremacy Clause of Article 6 of the Constitution. But this is a different kind of constitutional law. This is based on a reading of what Congress has done. Congress has much more authority, very broad authority, in this arena, unlike other areas of constitutional law. I think we'll talk about birthright citizenship in a bit, where Congress can come back and say, oh, no, here's what we meant, or it's okay, or states can have their own systems. Moreover, I think a risk, and one we have to keep in mind in considering a lot of these different kinds of issues, is whether Congress might even go more broadly, particularly if we have many more years of deadlock and just throw up their hands. We can't do anything. I'm getting pressured to do something. I'll vote for a measure that will essentially turn the states loose, to say there's no preemption concern about it, or at least in certain kinds of arenas. And so I think that should be another reason why it's important for all of us to work on some measure to accomplish that. And part of that, I would note that the mayor of Hazleton is now a member of Congress, so I should think he might be favorable to some step of that sort.
One quick last point on Candelaria. We're sitting in Washington. Many of you work on the Hill, have worked on the Hill, will work on the Hill. To the students in the audience, the Candelaria case points up the deep importance of legislative history. There isn't enough of this parenthetical clarifying what it means. I understand that's the fault of Muzaffar Chishti and others who were in the room when the legislative history was being developed. So when you work on comprehensive immigration reform, the bill that actually goes through in the coming years, try to do a better job on the legislative history than happened here. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. We didn't have great students working for us that time. But let me just – but it really is that those of you students, I mean, every word in the statute matters, and I lobbied that particular provision of IRCA deeply as to work in the American labor movement. I have no idea how those seven words went in there and what they meant. And so reference all of you. So let's go to SB 1070, everyone's on mind. Great success on Ninth Circuit, so where does it leave us on SB 1070 today?
Maybe before I go there, I wanted to kind of give a counterpoint to the previous panel. And I hate to be the kind of sad face at the party, especially because I'm going to be even more unpopular when I recommend that people actually look at the law that was passed in Utah and read it and think about what it means. Because the Utah Compact is one thing, but the Utah legislation, the package of bills that were passed in Utah, is a totally different thing. And if you start from the premise, as I think everyone on the panel did, that you don't want to create a 1070 in Utah. You don't want to go down the same road that Arizona went down. Maybe you want to scratch the itch, as it was said. You know, this is scratching that itch with like a belt sander. It's ridiculous. It's like to say that this avoids the mistakes of SB 1070 is just not true. What the Utah laws would do, is to create for at least 2 years an enforcement regime, a pure enforcement regime. There's no counterbalance with the proposed guest worker program aspect of it, for at least 2 years before that kind of goes into effect. And it creates an enforcement regime that looks very much like what Arizona did in SB 1070. And so I would, you know, I'd really encourage people to think, to look closely at the laws and to think seriously about whether, even if you accept the idea that you want to take the aspects of the Utah model that involve putting forth an alternative, maybe balancing different aspects of the legislative program, the way to do it, in my view, is not by enacting the bills that Utah enacted, because they don't actually do that. So that's kind of a lead into SB 1070 in the sense that, you know, where we are in SB 1070 is, I think, a lot of regret, as was expressed by General Goddard on the previous panel, in Arizona about having gone down that road. And also, you know, now both the district and the appellate courts having told Arizona that it was the wrong road to go down in a legal and constitutional sense. You know, that's I think the rulings from both the district and the appeals courts were quite clear and sent a very strong message to the state and to other states that the, you know, these kinds of enforcement measures that really try to put to create a state-controlled immigration enforcement system just aren't compatible with, you know, the way that immigration law is supposed to work in the United States, and with the division of authority, as Judge Noonan's concurrence points out most clearly, the division of authority between the federal government and the states in the immigration area.
So do you expect it's going to be headed clearly to the Supreme Court on 1070?
I don't think I'm always a lot of people have told me a lot of things over the year are clearly headed to the Supreme Court that don't get there. So I don't, I think there's right now there's no obvious, you know, obviously there's no disagreement among the courts on whether SB 1070 type laws are legal. You know, there's not, so there, at least one of the criteria by which the court usually chooses to whether or not to accept a case isn't there. And also, as again was pointed out earlier, you know, the expected tidal wave of these laws is not materialized. So the importance of this particular set of legal issues right now would seem to be confined to Arizona and possibly to Utah and, you know, Georgia. That, you know, especially in the absence of there being a circuit split, doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that immediately cries out for the Supreme Court's intervention.
Depending on how Candelaria gets decided by the Supreme Court, what impact, if any, is that going to have on SB 1070?
Well, you know, I mean, I think everyone here said, you know, the Supreme Court can write narrow and it can write broad. The Ninth Circuit, you know, the Ninth Circuit is where we lost in the Arizona case. You know, found it very easy to reconcile striking down SB 1070 on the one hand with having upheld the employer sanctions scheme on the other hand. So certainly, you know, it is easy, I think, for the courts to, you know, to keep the issues separate if they wish to.
Okay. So, David, just for you, I mean, the distinction between Candelaria and SB 1070, in SB 1070, the Obama administration decided to sue the state of Arizona. Obviously, a reasonably unusual move, I think. You were there, and could you tell us what went into that thought, and why was it different than the intervention in Candelaria, which was just not to do that in the beginning of when it, you know, when the cases were going up?
Well, I expressed what I think were the two different strands of thought that affected some of the early decisions in the Candelaria litigation before I was there in the Bush administration, which meant that the government did not take a stand in that litigation until the Supreme Court expressly asked the Solicitor General to do so. With SB 1070, this was a much bigger issue. It was a much more dramatic issue. It potentially has a much more disruptive effect on federal operations, on our foreign relations. Again, the Arizona Legal Arizona Workers Act was seen as the more moderate of the various bills there. The other more extreme versions were vetoed at the time of that. So it didn't raise as big an issue generally. This one does, but SB 1070, particularly in the way that it was amended about a week after its initial enactment, it's got some nuances in there that are a bit of a challenge for dealing with. I think the government effectively found ways to address that, particularly the provision about a mandate, basically, to check people wherever there's a stop, arrest, or detention, and there's reasonable suspicion of illegal status, and a further mandate to hold people who are arrested until their status is resolved. The Ninth Circuit, in resolving this, well, I guess I want to reflect on this in light of some of the things that Terry Goddard said in the earlier panel. I'm not sure it's going to take a really long time on remand. The legal theory that was employed by the Ninth Circuit in ruling on the preliminary injunction is a really quite a broad one and seems to hold out the prospect that the court on remand could decide, I don't need to hear to take factual submissions as a matter of law in the way that the Ninth Circuit has now established the law of the case, it's inappropriate to go forward in this way. That's mainly the portion of the opinion where they rely on a part of 287G that a lot of people hadn't looked at before this, 287G10, which says there's not an agreement of this kind is not required in order for the state to cooperate with the federal government in immigration enforcement. Arizona saw that as an open door for these sorts of activities. The federal government tried to argue that no, cooperation means something different. It means more that the federal government is in control. You're dealing with it on our priorities, not on Arizona's priorities. That was a bit of a challenging argument, but the Ninth Circuit supported it completely, and so they held that 287G10 is not a grant of authority for state officers to systematically enforce the INA outside of the restrictions set forth in the earlier provisions which provide for the agreements. So on that basis, there may be a solid basis for the court to rule as a matter of law fairly early and resolve it. It would probably go back to the Ninth Circuit. That might not take very long. If that happens, and I'm not sure that the Supreme Court would take it, again, in the absence of development of a conflict. And it may also be the earlier panel reflected on why we didn't see a wave of new laws. We saw a couple of them along the 1070 model. I think part of that was the reaction of the business community, but part of it probably has to do with the decision to challenge, for the federal government to step in and challenge the law, and at least so far, to gain some success. So states looked at a prospect of additional litigation. Utah does have many of the same features, but I do think that is the enforcement part of the Utah law. But Utah's law does address some of the problems that at least the district court saw in the Arizona law. So I think it's valid for them to say we tried to learn some things from the Arizona experience. But overall, the enforcement part of the Utah law does bear many, many parallels mm-hmm. to SB 1070.
So since that is parallels, are you planning to sue the state of Utah?
I guess you'll know when we sue, but if we sue. We're looking very closely at all the new laws that are passed, and I think we're, you know, certainly maybe not as – we may not wield as big a stick as the federal government does when it comes to discouraging states from doing things. But I do think that, that we certainly look at – litigation is one way to send a message about, what's acceptable and what's not. So, you know, we're looking at all the laws.
So Mike, as the great observer of the court, and since Justice Kagan is not conflicted in SB 1070, if it goes to the Supreme Court, how do you think it'll come down?
I hope I'm not on this panel because I'm a great observer of the court. hopefully Kagan will not recuse, but I think what happens in Candelaria may have a lot to say with it, and I agree with the comments about there's a number of scenarios in which the court doesn't take it at all, but if it takes it, Well, I think it will matter a lot whether it takes it at this stage, the preliminary injunction stage, or if it goes back down and is sort of there's a permanent injunction or some factual record is developed, it comes up that way. That will matter a lot. You know, this is a court that has embraced federal power in a lot of places, even while speaking of federalism. I think it's close. You know, I think it's close. I think that the Supreme Court should affirm what the Ninth Circuit has done. I actually wanted to focus on a different aspect, which I think would affect the court's resolution of the case, and maybe invite David to comment here, too. So one of the difficulties for the United States in the SB 1070 case is an opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel. That's the unit in the Department of Justice that gave us the torture memos and so forth, that for many years had held in a series of opinions that are binding only on the executive branch, that state and local police lack authority to do civil immigration enforcement. And in 2002, those prior decisions were partially rescinded or superseded by a 2002 opinion that said, no, actually, to the contrary, state and local police have the inherent authority to enforce civil immigration laws. And in the transition to the Obama administration, a number of people encouraged the new administration to include on its stroke of the pen kind of list of things to do the prompt repeal of the 2002 opinion and restoration of the prior OLC opinions. That didn't happen. And when the lawyer for the government, Ed Kneedler, a very experienced lawyer in the Solicitor General's office, was arguing before the Ninth Circuit in the SB 1070 case, I think he was sort of materially hampered when he received questions in this direction, because he was required to embrace the idea that Arizona law enforcement has the inherent authority to enforce civil immigration laws, which is a hard position to reconcile, I think, with the objections to SB 1070. I think the court didn't have so much difficulty there. They said, well, the 2002 opinion looks wrong to us. But I think the United States has a difficult position to defend, as it must, the positions set forth in this 2002 OLC opinion while also challenging SB 1070. So I think if it gets to the court and the Solicitor General's office is still constrained by the 2002 opinion, I think their arguments may face the same hurdles that that they faced in the Ninth Circuit. So I think it's a more likely win if that's not the case, and they can make a crisper, more direct set of responses to the questions they'll get.
This is an indirect way of asking David whether the administration is going to
Now he can comment a little bit more publicly because he's looking forward, not backwards.
OLC opinion?
Well, I'll say a couple things about it. First of all, nothing at OLC, at least these days, is done by a stroke of the pen. And I think that's partly learning some of the lessons of the Office of Legal Counsel opinions that had to be walked back that really were quite regrettable during in the Bush administration's war on terror. It reverts to a long and proud tradition of OLC where they look at these issues very carefully. So it's not a matter of just, oh, okay, we vacate one and we go back to the earlier one. It would be looked at very carefully by the fine lawyers in OLC and see where that might come out. It's not – one can't always control what you get back from OLC, and sometimes you can be surprised. So the question is whether that's worthwhile. What is the real impact of the 2002 opinion? There's a lot of misunderstanding about that opinion. It does not say there's an inherent authority in the states to enforce the civil immigration laws. It opines, contrary to the 1996 opinion, that there may be inherent authority to arrest in those circumstances. But a lot of people read into that, well, then they would basically take the person into immigration court, detain them, decide on the charges, and go forward with that. All it would mean would be the same as it means in the area where it is accepted that enforcement of the criminal laws, or generally accepted enforcement of the criminal laws, is appropriate. That doesn't mean that the state officers then prosecute that case in court. They hand it off to the U.S. attorney, and the U.S. attorney can decide whether or not they want to proceed. And pretty clearly, the U.S. attorney will say, you're not dictating our priorities. We're deciding on that. The 2002 OLC opinion, I'm told, was the impact of it was a big disappointment to its primary author, Chris Kobach. States didn't immediately rally and say, oh, this is great, we can do it. They're very worried about it. These are complicated laws. They're difficult to proceed with. So I don't think it's, although it's rhetorically used a lot in challenges to what states may do. It's a very infrequently used, but mostly rhetorically, by people like Joe Arpaio on the other side. The actual impact of that is pretty limited. The basic framework in which state and local cooperation proceeds is not through inherent pickup merely for a civil immigration violation. It's through cooperation in the criminal justice system, where there are a variety of arrangements, and actually DHS and INS before that encouraged that. Don't go out and pick people up, state and locals, because you think you know about the immigration laws. If you have somebody you've arrested validly on your own authority for a state law violation, then we may want to cooperate. That's a better place to focus our attention. So I think the 2002 OLC opinion, although it's symbolically very important, it has a limited framework. Whether we'll see a revisiting of that, I really don't know. There's certainly been discussions along those lines, but it's not a quick and simple thing.
Okay, let me ask two of you a very quick question on the last thing on SB 1070. We heard about the 8-page letter that Chairman Smith has written to Attorney General Holder asking that federal government sue the state of Utah on the compact. Do you think that's going to happen?
I'm probably the worst person. I mean, I unfortunately have no insight into the question. Except that I think that, I do think that the federal government's view, as expressed to the court in the 1070 case, is that one of the major problems with what Arizona did is that it creates a patchwork system that destroys the federal government's ability to uniformly, enforce the laws, uniformly create a set of enforcement priorities by which to guide the federal government's work, et cetera, et cetera. Those arguments, I think, both apply in these other states. And, to some degree, if a bunch of these laws pass and the federal government doesn't sue, it would lead you to wonder, why, if they really meant what they said in Arizona, why they wouldn't be suing in other places as well.
David, what's your bet? Would they sue them?
That's a very hard one. I think for the reasons that Omar mentioned, there are a number of problems with the enforcement part of the Utah Compact, the thing that's gotten less attention. It is a lot like the Arizona law, but not identical. So there may be a basis for the Justice Department to decide that that's different. But the main arguments that have been made, the public arguments about a patchwork of laws, that clearly does apply to Utah. So what Utah has done politically is very valuable, and I hope it becomes a model and kind of shames people or induces people from a variety of perspectives to try to come together in the same sort of way with a focus on the national decision-making process, because that really is where immigration policy ought to be made and where the main management enforcement ought to occur. But the law itself is not is quite problematic along those lines. So I was interested that they at least had some meeting at the Justice Department with Attorney General Shurtleff yesterday. The thing that Lamar Smith focused on, however, was he seemed to be more worked up about the provisions for guest worker provisions and for potential sponsored immigration under Utah law. Those don't take effect for a couple of years. Moreover, I just want to point out that's in a very different context from what we were struggling with as we tried to decide what to do at the federal government level about SB 1070. SB 1070 was going to take effect at the end of July. Police were going to be out there implementing that right away unless somebody stepped in and tried to get a preliminary injunction. I give the ACLU a great deal of credit also for stepping in earlier than we got our act together on doing that. The provisions that Smith focuses on, guest worker and sponsored immigration, those don't take effect for 2 years anyway. And I don't see any way that those can actually – you don't need to enjoin those. Even if those take place, if the federal government doesn't agree with it, and I can't see them possibly agreeing with it or providing a waiver, the fact that you have one of those Utah cards, guest worker cards, doesn't give you any kind of immunity against enforcement. Moreover, it won't allow you to come in – somebody to come in across the border if there's an agreement and – the state of Nuevo León has provided some kind of a card that CBP at the border will say, well, thanks very much, that's great, but you're not admissible, go away. So there are other ways to deal with some of these kinds of provisions, depending on the way they're structured, and assert federal authorities even without a preemptive lawsuit.
Okay, let me shift gear, because these are high-profile cases which are in the press all the time, but there are surprisingly large number of cases which are going through federal courts which have not as high profile, but have huge impact on people's lives.
And the first in that category is the new requirements for eligibility for public benefits. We know welfare reform was enacted in 96, and at that time we thought there will be a huge series of lawsuits challenging various of these restrictions, but none happened till very recently, and suddenly there's a spate of cases. Mike, you want to tell us what those cases are and what the issues are at stake?
Sure. So briefly, it's always fun to talk about the Supreme Court. It's the Supreme Court. They decide 80 cases a year. The Courts of Appeals decide about 45 or 50,000, and the lower federal courts, hundreds of thousands, and, of course, the state courts, even more than that. A lot of the action is happening a little bit below the radar. One of the areas, I think, where there is an increasing amount of litigation is over access to public benefits. The 96 Welfare Act, of course, famously restricted the eligibility of many legal immigrants for all sorts of federal, state, and cooperative federal state benefits programs. There was some litigation over state restrictions and federal restrictions in the late 90s, but not the tide of lawsuits that were expected, largely, I think, because states declined the federal invitation to substantially restrict benefits to legal immigrants. There were some states that did in some ways, but on the whole, much less than expected. Unfortunately, I think under the current economic times, which are especially challenging at the state and local level, where there's no borrowing, there's balanced budget requirements, and there's, of course, tremendous economic pressure, we're seeing more state restrictions now that we didn't see in the late 90s, states terminating benefits for immigrants who had been eligible up until now, eliminating substitute programs that were created to replace federal benefits that immigrants had lost and states made up for in the late 90s. And naturally, there are court challenges to those. I think there are at least a half a dozen cases out there in Hawaii, Washington State, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, where I'm from. The Connecticut Supreme Court just recently upheld, in the face of an equal protection challenge, the elimination of some state substitute programs for medical benefits for indigent legal immigrants. The cases out west are headed towards the Ninth Circuit. Others are making their way up. The early wave of litigation was split. There were four cases that went to the state high court or the U.S. Court of Appeals, and they basically split 2-2 to New York and Maryland, largely rejecting these kinds of restrictions, saying you can't discriminate between citizens and LPRs, lawful permanent residents, when it comes to benefits. Massachusetts and the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals saying, yes, you can. These programs vary in their details, so it's not always possible to precisely map them out. But we do see now a new round of cases, a new round of state restrictions, unfortunately, in the face of budget pressure, and therefore likely the issues moving up again.
Let me stay with you for a second. There's also a huge number of cases going around against ICE agents and senior ICE officials, mostly in the damage actions on the nature of arrests that are made by ICE agents and the conditions in detention. I hear you have a lot to do with some of these cases, so could you tell us what's at stake in this litigation?
Sure. I actually think this may be one of the most consequential legal developments of the last couple of years. For many years, state and federal law enforcement officials have been subject to civil rights lawsuits upon allegations of excessive force or false arrest or racial profiling, things like that. These go back to the 60s in some cases, cases brought under Section 1983 or the Bivens decision or the Federal Tort Claims Act. But there's been one group of law enforcement officers who've been largely immune from the limited judicial oversight. Of course, few people who are abused by law enforcement get a lawyer and go to court. But nevertheless, limited judicial oversight of some law enforcement excesses has probably played a helpful role in improving accountability, transparency, creating incentives for supervisors to improve law enforcement training, and so on. But immigration agents have long claimed an immunity, alone among federal and state law enforcement officials, have long argued that the INA, especially after 96, precludes judicial review of claims outside the removal track, and therefore precludes constitutional civil rights and constitutional tort actions. And this has left ICE agents alone, again, largely alone, FBI, DEA, they all occasionally face civil rights cases when there are allegations that they've overstepped, that they've been abusive or violent. But in the last, I think really sort of prompted by the stepped-up enforcement of 06 and 07, the raids in work sites and residential communities, and a lot of claims in the media by local residents, by activists, about excessive ICE actions and ICE behavior acting with impunity, there have been a wave of lawsuits that look a lot like police brutality cases from the 60s, except they just haven't been allowed previously against immigration agents. The difference is that the district courts, with some exceptions, but the general trend seems to be to say ICE agents don't look a lot different than FBI agents or DEA agents. And if an FBI agent kicks down a door without a warrant and grabs someone by the hair, that can be a problem. And if an ICE agent does it, we don't see them differently. These cases are, working their way up, mostly at the district court level. Some are now reaching the Third Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Second Circuit. And it may be that the courts of appeals or eventually the Supreme Court cuts these off, agrees with the government's arguments that ICE agents are immune from civil rights liability. But I don't think that's likely to be the outcome. And so it may be that going forward, that little bit of judicial oversight that comes from the occasional civil rights suit becomes an incentive to better management practices, better training, better supervision, becomes a little bit of a deterrent to some of the misconduct that occurred, has occurred. And I think that may be a very helpful thing. But I do think that we've seen a wave of these cases largely going forward in the district courts, and whether this ends up resulting in institutional changes, it remains to be seen.
And same is true with respect to suppression motions increasingly receiving some welcome reception at the BIA. Can you just quickly comment on that development?
Yeah, it's notable we're having a talk about litigation. We have hardly talked about the INA. We're talking about state and local laws. We're talking about welfare, other areas. So the flip side of some of the claims of excessive force, arrests without probable cause, searches without consent or warrants, the flip side to those civil rights lawsuits has been the proliferation of suppression motions in immigration proceedings with immigration advocates contesting the legality of the search or the seizure or the questioning. And while immigration judges had largely not seen too much of them, the suppression motions have been around. They're established in most circuits, but they're rarely made. They have become much more common, and I think immigration judges have become much more accustomed to handling them, to adjudicating them, to taking evidence about how the ICE agents behaved, whether the evidence was legally obtained. And certainly to my surprise, anyhow, the BIA has begun affirming a lot of these. The BIA has upheld grants of suppression motions or vacated and remanded the denial of suppression motions. But it's often the same Fourth Amendment claims as are being litigated in the civil rights cases coming up through the immigration system.
That's great. So, David, just to you on this, as the former principal deputy general counsel of DHS, do you take a dim view of these lawsuits against ICE agents, or do you think this is a healthy trend to make them more accountable?
Well, I'm not in favor of a lot of suits against ICE agents, but I think we'll see how these cases come out. I don't think it's a big problem if the immigration enforcement system is essentially mainstreamed in the civil rights kind of lawsuits, the Bivens lawsuits. I'd just like to emphasize there are a number of efforts underway, maybe partly catalyzed by that began really in the previous administration, but also because of a real commitment on the part of a lot of the leadership of DHS to improve training, to change priorities, to issue different directives about how things are supposed to be done, such as fugitive operations teams, about what sorts of very limited circumstances one would do enforcement actions at a home. There are a number of those sorts of things. Those are actually, in the long run, going to be more important to actually changing the way in which enforcement is carried out. But so we'll see how the lawsuits come out. But I don't think I wouldn't be terribly troubled for the future of effective enforcement if we can mainstream it in that way. Suppression is a little bit different. I think suppression has always been available on the basis of egregious actions, very significant allegations of due process violations. The system won't work very well, though, if those become absolutely routine or if the standard is very low for doing suppression in those settings. And there are also other complications about if evidence is suppressed, well, what about, you know, the individual arrests usually are not suppressed anyway, and so the cases may proceed. So I'm less sanguine about that process, but the rest of it, I think, is part of an overall effort to try to enhance the professionalism and accountability of agents, immigration enforcement agents generally, and a lot of that has to come through internal efforts on training, monitoring, managerial approaches, and, well, also the Office of various internal monitors, such as the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. We'll be hearing from Margot Schlanger, who heads up that office, later today.
Okay, last set of issues are, there's no litigation in any of these, but it's hard to escape that they're on everyone's mind as legislators are beginning to gear up. And these are both involving unauthorized immigrants. One is potential challenge to the right of unauthorized kids to basic K-12 education in a case guaranteed by Plyer versus Doe. And the other is the challenge to the birthright citizenship of kids born to U.S. citizens, U.S. citizen-born kids of unauthorized. So let me start quickly with you, David. I mean, you are a Powell clerk, and Justice Powell provided the critical fifth vote in the Plyler case. And you could argue that a lot of states are enacting these measures against the costs of providing public education to the unauthorized kids in the states. Do you think Plyler is an endangered species or no?
Well, it's possible. It was a narrow ruling at the time. It's a very different court that we have right now. But actually, my guess would be that we would not see that erode insofar as it applies to elementary and secondary education. I think the basic situation that persuaded the court narrowly back in the early 80s in Plyler still exists. It's a really severe measure to decide that, well, the way we're going to get a handle on any kind of illegal migration problem is by keeping kids out of school. So I hope we don't go down that road. I don't think that the court will. Now, one other feature that might crop up at some point might be efforts such as Elton Gallagly pushed in 1996. He's now the chair of the House subcommittee. He wanted to enact legislation, including the 1996 legislation, a provision that would essentially say that as far as Congress is concerned, it would be great if states would exclude illegal aliens from education. That was fought back by the Clinton administration. There was a lot of focus on that. But people have wondered about that. Well, wait a minute, isn't this an equal protection ruling? But the equal protection ruling in Plyler is a bit unusual. It's like a lot of equal protection in this arena. It seems to partake a little bit more of a preemption flavor. It's some things that the federal government can do to draw distinctions the states can't do, but, well, maybe they could do if there was a little more of a sign that there was support from the federal government. And there's a line in Plyler that says, as part of the court's reasoning in responding to the state of Texas's argument that, well, wait, we're just using a federal categorization here, lawful versus unlawful migrant, the court said, we are reluctant to impute to Congress the intention to withhold from these children, for so long as they are present in this country through no fault of their own, access to a basic education. In the absence of any contrary indication fairly discernible in the present legislative record, we perceive no national policy that supports the state in denying these children an elementary education. That's what Representative Gallagly wanted to rely on. Okay, let's send that signal. Let's see what may happen in response to that.
Umar, are you gearing up for this challenge? Are there any states where this is a ripe thing to happen? And if those are, what are those states?
Well, you know, I mean, I note that both on the K-12 issues and on the birthright citizenship issue, the last package that was proposed in Arizona involved measures on both of those as well as others, and it failed, you know, even in Arizona. So, and again, in part, I think, due to a maybe a slight shift in the political climate, but I think also, you know, a lot of people view these kinds of things as a bridge too far. I think it'll you know, I think there's a good chance that, that these are not going to materialize anywhere. And so we won't have the chance necessarily to challenge them.
Okay. Back burner at ACLU, huh? Let me just turn to birthright citizenship very quickly because we need to leave a few minutes for the questions. Is the challenge to 14th Amendment's guarantee, or at least supposed guarantee, of birthright citizenship to every person born in this country, even to the unauthorized, is this a serious legal issue or is this just political grandstanding?
I think on this one, the Supreme Court is very unlikely to change the accepted understanding for 100 years of the Fountainhead case, Wong Kim Ark. Wong Kim Ark didn't technically involve someone who was an undocumented or unauthorized alien. Categories didn't quite exist in that way, but it has been read. It was a divided vote, but it has been read. It read the 14th Amendment to essentially say virtually anybody born in this country, saving the children of diplomats and a few other very limited cases, are citizens at birth. And it's been implemented in hundreds of thousands, millions of cases as an understanding that essentially the fact of birth here, whatever the parent's status is, it gives rise to citizenship. I don't see the court changing that. The tagline in there is that persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens at the time of birth of the state and of the United States. It's a pretty extraordinary claim to say that people who are here unlawfully, unlike diplomats who have a variety of immunities, are not subject to the jurisdiction. They're subject to the jurisdiction. If they commit a crime, they're going to be punished. If they're caught and placed into enforcement proceedings in immigration, that would happen. So I don't think it fits very well. But I think it's worth reflecting for just a moment. Why do we see this coming up once again in a fairly focused way? It cropped up about 25 years ago based on a book by Peter Schuck and Roger Smith, which I think both of them have had some second thoughts about, at least as a matter of policy. But it's cropping up now for, I think, for three basic reasons, and they merit some reflection. One, it's a very popular position. Recent Rasmussen poll a week or two ago showed that 61% of likely voters favor cutting back on birthright citizenship, not allowing it to people who are here unlawfully or who are here as tourists. Secondly, it's, at least initially when you come to it, it's a pretty appealing argument initially in favor of those who say, why would we give out something as important as citizenship based on somebody just being here briefly as a student or a tourist, or certainly being here unlawfully? It's superficially attractive. I'll come back to that in a minute. And then the third one, I think, hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but I believe it may be that it's a response to what has been one of the most effective arguments on behalf of those who want a more generous immigration policy or who want to defeat certain enforcement measures by the federal government, and that is the appeal, oh, you're breaking up families. Those provide the very photogenic opportunities on TV. And so people are saying, okay, if it's going to break up families, let's go to the source of the problem. That shouldn't be families. There shouldn't be a problem here. Now, there's a legal error there also, and I think it's important to reflect on that. There's no provision here or in any other country that has generous birthright citizenship rules that provides a sort of defense to deportation to the parent just because there's a citizen child. And the case law we have in this country, limited as it is, says that's fine. You can't deport the citizen, but the parents, as in many other in any other situation about important life decisions, parents make a choice then. If they're leaving to the home country, they decide. If they have something for the children to do here, fine. If they take the children with them, the children's citizenship status is not jeopardized. And I think it's really important if we're going to hang on to the birthright citizenship rules we have right now, to reemphasize, to reassure a lot of people that that doesn't mean a giant loophole in the overall enforcement system for anybody who can have a child while they're here. But I think beyond that, the other part of it is just I think what needs to be highlighted to defeat this is to talk about what would be the consequences. This is probably the least effective, most counterproductive way to try to deal with illegal migration. If this is the measure that we're in, that partisans are able to get enacted, and not much else on illegal migration, we are sowing the seeds for a second and third generation problem down the road that European countries have faced and we have not. And it's been a great blessing for our country not to have to face situations of alienated young people who were born here and have only known this society. Secondly, I mean, it would be an enormous a problem for registrars of birth and for the handing out of various kinds of documents. And finally, then beyond that, if that's all we do, we create the second-generation problem. If, on the other hand, we're finally able to take some effective steps to greatly reduce illegal migration in the future, I'd like to see it done through comprehensive immigration reform, then this issue becomes a very small issue, and we shouldn't deal with it. I think we have to make that kind of a very practical case much more effectively. But in the meantime, I don't expect that the court will allow it, but there are proposals for constitutional amendments, and with 61% support and kind of easy sound bites on this and complicated sound bites on the other hand, on the other side, I worry a little bit about that ball getting rolling.
Mike, you want to say last words on both these things before we turn to the audience?
I agree with Omar and David. it's going to be fine. I don't think that these are – I don't think this court is going to truck with these arguments. But I do want to, as a last word, say there's another dog that didn't bark here. We've talked this morning on this panel particularly about litigation around the enforcement provisions, the anti-immigrant, the restrictionist provisions. There's a whole world of what I think of as incremental, pragmatic, integrationist measures happening at the state and local level, which aren't – prompting lawsuits, or in the few occasions where they have, are easily succeeding. So I just want to tick off very briefly from the state of Connecticut, where I know, but this is the kind of stuff that's under the radar, but is not prompting litigation. There's actually a whole positive move out there. So in Connecticut, New Haven and Hartford have municipal confidentiality policies. Hartford's is the strongest in the country. No lawsuits filed. New Haven has an optional municipal identification card for all residents, regardless of immigration status. No lawsuit filed. Most towns have accommodated day laborers, in Stamford in particular. No lawsuits filed. The State Department of Labor, after the Hoffman Plastic decision called into question labor and employment protections for undocumented immigrants, made sure to clarify that it would continue to enforce state and labor employment laws without regard to immigration status. No lawsuits filed. Just a month or so ago, the State Probation Office, which, like a lot of criminal justice organs, had been approached by ICE, asked to better network its databases with ICE databases, in fact, created a new form that all probation officers in the state of Connecticut had to complete at their first interview with a probationer about their immigration status, and if they had any questions, to fax it to ICE. Probation just rescinded that entire policy and said, henceforth, if ICE calls us, we'll answer their call, but we are no longer going to forward them information. We've abolished the form. No lawsuits filed. The in-state tuition bills in other states are coming to Connecticut. They passed a few years ago. The governor vetoed it. We have a new governor who said, I will sign it. That bill is moving through the legislature, and hopefully it will pass. I think it will. The few challenges to in-state tuition bills in other parts of the country have failed, either on standing grounds or on the merits. So there's a world of positive activity, integrationist, incremental, not trying to make a whole state immigration policy, but just the work of mayors and governors and police chiefs and library heads and hospital directors trying to adapt their systems to the realities of our new demographics. And that work is largely happening outside the courts and without interruption. And I think that's an important part of this story. Those who are going a different path, like Arizona, are tied up in court and hopefully will fail. But those who are choosing a different path aren't even in court.
So on that note,
sorry, and if I could just – I just didn't want to leave the idea hanging out there that the birthright stuff might be a back burner issue for the ACLU.
my God. I already got a tweet.
I want to be very clear that – yeah, that is actually, should the conditions arise, an argument that we are, looking forward to having. And I think one that really reveals a lot about the folks who are behind a lot of other state and local measures that maybe don't go quite as far. But, this is a question about whether you're going to undo or try to undo, a critical part of the constitutional amendment that ended slavery and that the birth citizenship component of which was specifically put there to avoid the perpetuation of an undercast, underclass of people who weren't equal to other people. That is I think a breathtaking thing that folks who were hostile to immigrants are willing to do as a way to further express and further further their hostility towards those people. And like I said, I mean, it's something that we would be happy to have a debate with them on.
Okay, good. Front burner issue, they say. So let's take a few questions from the audience before we break. There are two mics, one on the right, one on the left. Please identify yourself.
My name is Denise Gonzalez, and this is regarding your statements about the civil rights challenges of individuals who have been abused by ICE agents. Just if you could clarify, you said that we'll see if the Supreme Court agrees that ICE officers are immune from these challenges. Could you please clarify what the basis of that immunity is?
I don't know if it'll go to the Supreme Court, but certainly courts of appeals will weigh in, and maybe the Supreme Court. The arguments the government have made are several. First, under the Immigration and Nationality Act, there are a series of provisions that say any challenge to a removal proceeding shall go through the channels of immigration court, the BIA, and the courts of appeals. And ICE has argued that these channeling provisions preclude separate civil rights litigation about anything having to do with commencement of proceedings, enforcement, and so on. And so they've said that there are statutes that preclude civil rights actions against ICE agents, number one. The courts have generally rejected that. Number two, as to Bivens' claims in particular, which is not statutory, it's a Supreme Court case that recognized a constitutional tort action directly under the Constitution. The government, ICE, has argued that special factors counsel against recognizing a Bivens action in a new domain. And that's language from Supreme Court cases saying we won't necessarily extend Bivens into new domains. And ICE has said, well, immigration is connected to foreign affairs and so on, and it's a new domain, and you shouldn't extend Bivens. So far, the courts have generally said, actually, kicking down doors and roughing people up were the facts of Bivens itself. There's no more quintessential Bivens act that involved FBI agents. There's no more quintessential action than the kind of Fourth Amendment, excessive force, arrest without probable cause, unreasonable seizure claims that are here, and they've generally rejected that. But those have been the two principal arguments, I think. There have been some more nuanced ones depending on the facts of the case, but those have appeared across the cases.
The other question that I had was, have you seen any, or is there any discussion of possible claims against the federal government for actions of police officers, so in the sense of having some kind of vicarious responsibility for what police officers are doing in the midst of collaboration programs? Or agency or vicarious responsibility?
It's a fantastic question. I want to resist the temptation to get into the nuances of it, but under Section 1983, when federal officers essentially participate jointly with state officers and then violate the Constitution, there are 1983 conspiracy cases that say that's impermissible. And in a case, my clinic just settled for $650,000 about the arrest of day laborers by local police and ICE agents working together. The court recognized in refusing to dismiss Section 1983 conspiracy claims that when ICE agents essentially collaborate in some local race-based or otherwise unlawful action, they may have liability under conspiracy theories that are well settled. And one benefit there for the lawyers in the room is, of course, Section 1983 brings attorney's fees. Bivens and FTCA does not. So keep that in mind.
Thank you very much.
Any there? Well, it looks like we've stunned this crowd, so thank you so much. I'm sorry. Could you just beat it down?
I'm sorry. My name's Matthew Archibald. I'm an immigration attorney. I practice in Philadelphia. And one thing that my bar is wondering about is just Attorney General Holder has said that he's not going to enforce DOMA. And we have, me and my colleagues have clients who are married, gay marriage, and would like to be able to petition their spouses. I'm just wondering if there's any, this is all very new, if maybe the ACLU or anyone else knows of actions that's going to go on to try to be able to give gay couples the same rights that straight couples have as far as immigration.
I know of two cases in the Ninth Circuit.
Could you quickly?
I'm going to invite these guys may know more.
No, go ahead.
Well, I would just say, all right, the Holder statement, which was based on consultations with the president, said they would not defend it in court, but they would go ahead and enforce the law until there's a definitive ruling. And that reflects, it's a very difficult issue about the role of the Justice Department in defending statutes. It's a very big deal not to defend it. So although that's a hard distinction for a lot of people to follow in these kinds of circumstances, that does build on a lot of prior Justice Department practice. So the basic provision is that, yes, these measures are continuing to be enforced, but looking toward a definitive ruling from the courts one way or the other, and then that would be followed in the implementation.
I will say a word. You may have seen the news the other day, just yesterday, actually, that so the Justice Department took this position. We will enforce but not defend. The Speaker of the House may appoint counsel to defend the statute. Speaker Boehner said he would. He hired Paul Clement, former Solicitor General, very highly regarded lawyer in the Bush administration, who was at the firm of King & Spalding. The firm decided we aren't going to take this work on. And yesterday, 2 days ago, Clement quit the firm and said, I have an obligation to my client, Speaker Boehner. I said I would defend DOMA all over the country. So he quit the firm and is continuing to, I presume, vigorously represent the U.S. government in defending these cases. I know that DOMA, I'm told there are 10 or 11 DOMA challenges generally out there, more than some of the LGBT rights community lawyers knew of, two of which are immigration cases in the Ninth Circuit, others arising in other circumstances. And the expectation is that Clement will appear in all 11 of those cases. There's more percolating at the administrative level than various regimes, and will defend DOMA until a court rules on it.
And he'll be doing that on behalf of the Congress, not the U.S. government.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay, folks, thank you so much. Could we give this panel a round of applause?
For more information, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/U.S. immigration.